Greetings, friends. My name is Jessa McLean, and I'm here to provide you with some blueprints of disruption. This weekly podcast is dedicated to amplifying the work of activists, examining power structures, and sharing the success stories from the grassroots. Through these discussions, we hope to provide folks with the tools and the inspiration they need to start to dismantle capitalism, decolonize our spaces, and bring about the political revolution that we know we need. Welcome to the Blueprint Studio. Can you introduce yourself, please?
Hi, my name is Andy Crosby. I'm a postdoctoral researcher at Carleton University. That's an unceded and unsurrendered Algonquin territory, and I'm in the Department of Geography.
We really called you on. That's great. But you wrote a book that we're dying to get into. And in my research of you, there's actually two books. So you might have to come back on because your one on surveilling Indigenous resistance, like it's a whole other thing to unpack. So I wish, either way, we'll have to get you in for a twofer later, perhaps. But it's resisting eviction that our audience will be really interested in right now, because we have talked a lot about tenant rights and tenant organizing and resisting in all kinds of ways. So I'm excited to kind of unpack a few of the themes in your book, but also to hear a little bit more about the case study that you focus on at Heron Gate in Ottawa, which it has been labeled as the largest urban eviction in Canadian history. Reading the kind of notes for your book, it's 4 years of research that you did on this particular case study. Can you share a little bit what that was like before we get into what you found?
Definitely, yes. It's a great question to kind of start to get a bit more context. And I can talk a little bit more about how I came to it and my background. I don't like talking about myself so much, but I mean, in this situation, the context is, and I talk about it in the books, but there's a context for it. And as you mentioned, yes, so I've co-authored this other book on policing Indigenous movements. And so I have this kind of experience of doing kind of organizing and social justice work, mainly in the Ottawa area, but I've lived in other cities before that. I worked for a long time with the Leveler newspaper in Ottawa, which is this great, small, kind of progressive or left-wing newspaper. And I also worked with the Public Interest Research Group at Carleton, the OPIRG there. While I was doing this type of work, I really had the privilege of engaging in academic writing and research, which most folks don't get to do until they become students and beyond. But I was able to kind of bridge kind of community justice, social justice, research work. You know, we're always doing research. Activists are always doing their own research and trying to understand the struggles they're involved in and the opponents, the forces that they're struggling against.
We probably just don't think of it as research, though, because you say it and I'm like, no, we don't. Yes, we do. And now that you describe it, we absolutely do.
It's right. It's true, right? It's like we're always engaged in research work. And I feel like even kind of where I am at this moment, kind of, you know, I'll hop all over this last 15, 20 years, but where I am now, I feel where I can help most doing kind of movement work now outside of academia, but also bridging it with academia, is this research element. And it's not just academics or students or postdocs like myself or profs or whatever that can engage in this. The folks that I am organizing with and engaged with right now, they're doing their own work. They're not necessarily in the academy as such. So they are journalists. They are tenant organizers. They're housing justice activists. And we all bring different types of skills to the table. So I don't have this grand background in tenant organizing. And I kind of came to this research, you know, not purposefully. I didn't set out to do this research. I didn't set out to write a book on tenants resisting eviction. It just kind of happened organically, but it's through my work with these organizations they're small groups that I mentioned, the newspaper and things like that. So before I even went back to school, I went back to school in 2018 in the fall to do a PhD. But even before that, tenants in Heron Gate and organizers there reached out to me through my involvement with these other groups, and they were reaching out to a lot of different folks at the time to kind of bring people into their struggle, which you mentioned they were up against this mass eviction. So they were looking for support with media work, support with research. So I have this big, I have this background in access to information research, or ATIP, ATI, FOI, Freedom of Information. There's a lot of acronyms to describe that type of research. And if, for your listeners that may be unfamiliar with it, it basically just involves submitting requests for information to institutions, usually government institutions or policing institutions, security institutions, for their internal documents that they would not normally disclose to the public. So this is a great way. It can be a really effective way. It has a lot of challenges, mind you, but it can be an effective way to understand how institutions and powerful actors in society operate. By getting a glimpse into some of their internal processes, the documents they produce, and things like that. Basically, they reached out to me for help with those types of things. So media work, kind of networking on campus. I had a foot on campus and doing the access to information research. So I became involved with working with folks in Herengate and coincidentally started a PhD around that time, and then it somehow they kind of just morphed into each other, and I ended up taking it on as kind of my PhD research, which I had never proposed to do, but it kind of just happened. And the link between the policing Indigenous movements element, so my kind of academic research that I was engaged in the years leading up to this and at the current at that time, and still I'm still doing that type of research, is really interested in the policing of and criminalization of social movements. In particular Indigenous movements, but also any type of social movement. In the summer of 2018, Herengate tenants were kind of in this protracted battle with the landlord there. Basically, at that time, the landlord and tenants were organizing on social media. They were garnering attention toward their struggle against this eviction. They were resisting eviction. They were trying to organize all residents to stay put, to refuse to move, and that really pissed off the landlord. Who had threatened them with a series of cease and desist letters and various kind of legal tactics to try to silence them, to basically shut down their Twitter account was one of their goals. And in doing so, in trying to compel Twitter to permanently disable the Herengate Tenant Coalition's Twitter account, the landlord's lawyers told Twitter that the Herengate Tenant Coalition organizers were criminals and extremists. They were unstable. They were unhinged. So this was a real kind of wow moment for me, that where I kind of, you know, both my research interests kind of connected, and I'm like, okay, well, I'm going to take this and dig further into it. And that's how it became an academic project.
Well, I can see why you would pick up that story. I mean, what a villain, a real David and Goliath story. But you also talk about your own experience with dem evictions. And when we had Ricardo Trangen on as well, he had experience with evictions and precarious housing. And, you know, you talk about it being organic. I think obviously that played into it a little bit. We shit on developers a lot here. Rightfully so. Real estate investment, I mean, our audience is not unaware of the role that they play in evictions and the housing market in general. But when you talk about these freedom of information requests, it reminds me that one of the points that I felt was driven home in resisting eviction and the Herengate eviction is the role the municipalities play. Because this is where we can maybe give a little bit more context, because this is a huge redevelopment plan for like a pie-shaped neighborhood. Like, it's not just one building or two buildings. It really is an entire neighborhood that's just being redeveloped. And I use scare quotes because I'm sure Andrew has a much better way to describe what the city of Ottawa, in their quest to be livable, is doing to this unique neighborhood, right?
So yeah, you're right. So when I talk about what's going on there, and when folks there talk about what's going on, it's one of the things that comes up that surprises people, and people are like, how can this happen? Quite easy how it could happen. And if we get into the kind of settler colonial context of property in this country, but how can this one entity, this one large landlord, own this sizable chunk of land that where thousands of people live. There's hundreds and hundreds of rental units. There's hundreds and hundreds of townhomes, which is really important because a lot of larger families live there and intergenerational families. And Harringate is this racialized community where lots of immigrants and refugee families come. And the townhomes in particular, you know, these 3 and 4 bedroom townhomes with front and backyards, basement, 2 stories. They offer housing to large families. But Harringate also has low-rise apartment buildings, mid-rise buildings, and even high-rise buildings. So there's hundreds, there's thousands of tenants that live there. And it's a lower-income neighborhood. It's been kind of captured or purchased or obtained by this multi-billion dollar, what I call a real estate, a financialized real estate investment firm. And there's lots of different names for them.
I could think of a few.
Yeah. Yeah. This one company, this one firm or entity, that's where a lot of the research comes in. We try to figure out who these players are. Who actually owns the land. We're still digging into around like pension funds and stuff because we're finding out through tenant struggle elsewhere here and elsewhere that, you know, pension funds own a lot of the land that tenants are organizing around to be able to stay in their homes and to have affordable housing and whatnot. We can't really use access to information research we can't submit a request to Timber Creek Asset Management, which is now Hazelview Investments. That's the landlord / owner / asset manager. Or whatever they are that controls Harringate, property manager, landlord, whatever. If we submitted a letter to them asking for their internal records, they're not going to open the letter. But since they are this type of publicly traded company, we can get a lot of information because, you know, they produce a lot of documents to try to get people like us,
shareholders,
shareholders to invest in them. Anyone. And I think that's an interesting aspect of thinking about housing in Canada, where any person can invest in this type of housing quite easily, I think, with the technology and online platforms there are now, you know, in theory allows a lot of Canadians to become like landlords without doing any of that dirty landlord work, and they can profit from rents and all the nasty stuff that goes with trying to enhance profits out of housing as a financial asset.
I just want to add, it also reinforces that too big to fail mentality, where when you go and start to challenge the concept of real estate investment and the commodification of home, which you talk about in your book, sometimes the pushback is, well, then everyone's pension will fail. You know, then you're screwing seniors. And it's kind of like that cycle that we've played into where it's a domino effect. Should we start to kind of go after one type of investment, but not to say that doesn't mean to plow ahead, but it's just like, it's maddening, right? Because it just adds another layer upon layer of resistance to dismantling it.
Yeah, definitely. And that's why you have to give so much credit to like the tenants that are on the ground in Toronto and elsewhere, you know, engaging in rent strikes and withholding rent and publicly going after the people that control their housing, and whether that's like part asset manager, part like financialized landlord, and then part pension fund, these super powerful entities in our society. And then you have, you know, tenants who, if we look at that kind of David and Goliath kind of aspect of it, have relatively lesser power. But together, I think tenant struggles is a way to level that kind of playing field, if you will. But still acknowledging these types of companies and firms, they have unlimited financial resources, legal resources. So even the Harringate Tenant Coalition engaged in a number of legal cases against Timber Creek / Hazelview, which you'd think would be quite risky, and a really interesting topic for debate around tactics and strategies and whatnot. I think the Harringate case shows us that, you know, these types of tenant victories against these powerful entities, there's not often a lot of them, but there's things we can glean from those struggles, across struggles, different tactics that may work. And obviously one of the main messages coming out of tenant organizing and the people that are engaged in that is that, you know, solidarity, building tenant power together can yield positive results.
let's unpack tactics, right? That we do a lot of that on Blueprints of Disruption, right? Because the goal is to find a way forward. And there are many ways to do it. But the Heron case legal challenge in the Ontario Human Rights Tribunal, as far as I can tell, is just sitting there still. I mean, it's momentous. It's an important case. It would set a precedent that would really impact landlords. So I can only imagine they're doing everything they can to drag this out. But they're talking about costs of over $100,000 to bring this to court. And for a grassroots tenant organization, I mean, solidarity donations come in, yes, but like that seems like an insurmountable sum. And I know you do talk a little bit about, actually a lot about tactics. In your book, you even make a comment where I feel like you're kind of admiring the folks that spend most of their energy building people power as opposed to begging politicians for small changes in policy here and there. And so I wouldn't mind your opinion. Obviously, I called you on the show, so I would love it. On doing a legal challenge, because what they're doing is actually legal, right? Like the way the tenant, the investment firm and the landlord and the municipality are, like, technically it's legal, but it's an abuse of their human rights, right? The appeal there that they're making is because it's a cultural enclave and there's support systems. And that comment you made about intergenerational homes was really important because there's just no replacement for it anywhere in the city, right? So like they would just be dismantling this cultural community that lean on one another out of necessity. And it's like the last low income area in Ottawa, like in the Ottawa region. So like you're really pricing all of these people out of a home. The human rights appeal is quite costly. And I'm wondering what you think about it and its prospects.
Yeah, and that's a really great point and excellent question. Yeah, I'm not sure where the fundraising is at. And when was the case initiated? Like 2019? That we're going on 5 years. And this has been the same with all the other cases. This is a big case, a bigger case. The other cases that went through like small claims court and stuff like this. And same kind of tactics by an entity that has unlimited financial and legal resources to kind of drag them out, to get them dismissed, always bringing motions forward to try to, you know, different types of motions and hearings to stall. I've witnessed more of what's happened in those small claims courtrooms, but these are just tactics they use to try to get the cases thrown out, and for the most part have been unsuccessful. So, you know, the Heron Gates legal team really sees them as kind of stalling tactics and efforts to try to drain resources from this small grassroots groups with very limited resources. But that's kind of classic, I think. If go back to the academic literature, I think that's classic literature on like slap suits and things like that. And that's kind of 101 what big entities are trying to do when they try to engage in the legal arena to demobilize kind of social movement opposition. I think that some of the strength of kind of what groups like the Heron Gate Tenant Coalition and others are doing, you're right, they're not appealing to larger forces for policy changes or legislative changes. I feel like they see that as largely a dead end. But that's not to take away from the kind of more institutionalized tenant rights advocacy kind of groups that are pushing for those. Like, you know, they're doing good work as well. It's just different work. And I think slowly in some cities you see some positive changes. I heard something on the radio in Ottawa this morning. I missed it, but it was something about a renoviction bylaw or something. So there's kind of pushes and I would say only through struggle do these things come on the larger political radar, municipal, provincial, and federal. You know, like the federal government recently launched this review panel to look at the financialization of rental housing. Oh, maybe financialization isn't a great thing. But why is this on the radar? I don't think it's because the government of the day just kind of, you know, thought it's, oh, this maybe this is something we should look at. This is from tenants kind of pushing these direct action tactics and these kind of public shaming style tactics and, you know, more direct action, going to the annual meetings or whatever they're doing and putting it out on social media, garnering mainstream media attention. and just and creating conversations and bringing it into the public spotlight. So yeah, you're right. Like, and what Timber Creek, Hazelview, what these companies are doing is technically legal, and they will always emphasize that, because they'll always emphasize, well, this is what we're doing is legal, and we're going above and beyond what's required. So when they were evicting and trying to get rid of everyone in Harringate, and they were offering, like, so, you know, legally they have to give like 3 months notice to dem evict someone, and I think they were giving like 3.5 or 4 months. So they would emphasize that, and they got to give something like first and last month's rent, but they were offering a bonus. So they were, and I don't remember the exact details, I apologize, but, you know, they would just always emphasize that we're going above and beyond, and they would always use that terminology, above and beyond. We're offering more, we're helping them find alternative, like replacement housing, we're paying for moving costs, and we don't have to do this, but we're doing it because you know, we care. So there's that type of thing too, but you're right. Well, you know, well, we see some protections against rent evictions, even though we not, you know, I don't know if the research would show that they're effective, that there's recourse to being rent evicted. I think we'd have to look into that in a different location to see how effective those bylaws and provincial laws are.
All these laws that we're talking about are really centered on the financialization of shelter. And you have a quote here. When we talked to Ricardo Tranjan, he was trying to redefine, or helping us redefine, the class relation between tenant and landlord. You know, you talk a little bit about that, but one of the themes that you try to drive home, I feel, is the, and you call it the key conflict really of our time right now, is that of home and investment. You know, home being a living, breathing place, you know, of socialization and comfort, and then like juxtapose that with the real coldness and detachment of something just being an investment. And we've experienced it for so long, it's such a norm for us. But if you think about it, it's so fucked up, like, that we don't even know who owns our home. Because we've had tenants on from from Acorn, talking about like how they're trying to get to the bottom of whose fucking name to put on the documents that they need to serve them with, or whatever they're trying to do. And they're in a house every day, all day, their home, and they have no idea who owns it, who they're beholden to. And that is so completely normal, and it's becoming even more normal. And I just want to maybe, you know, Santiago, you haven't been able to chime in a little bit because I've been talking so much, but you've talked about that before, just the commodification of something so dear. Like, we've seen water, all, everything's commodified, but home to this extent is, it's also got to be doing something to our social fabric, not just like physically removing our communities, but like, that's such a detachment. It's inhumane, really, like, to live in something that's so commercialized in that way. And no one gives a fuck if they like kick you out, and mm-hmm. kick you and your grandkids out, and because they need to make a buck.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. It's really messed up. And it's, you know, so there's this aspect of the research aspect, trying to figure out who owns what and why is that so difficult. The pension funds make that harder they're really skittish around releasing any information around their investments. Like, they won't even say what addresses of places they own, and very basic information. I don't know. I'm confident that what folks are doing, a lot of different folks doing different organizing and research work, will eventually kind of push that, pensions themselves, but kind of these, what's it called, these divestment movements that we saw around kind of fossil fuels, at least on university campuses. I don't even know where that is anymore. Feels like that's just something that you've probably talked about it, maybe in other shows around that big social economic issue. But I feel like ongoing work will eventually kind of push that more into the public realm, where we'll actually get to talk about divestment.
So like, go beyond naming and shaming like the landlord, but to, you know, really push on these pension funds,
yeah,
to invest ethically.
Yeah, because a lot of them are like, you know, the big funds in Canada, like, and then for the provinces, the biggest types of funds are these public sector, you know, they're public sector worker, they're teachers' funds, they're nurses' funds. I feel there's inroads to be made there. I try to be optimistic. I feel like most people don't want to have to be investing or to rely on their income when they retire based on displacing people, you know, but based on kicking out people and bringing in other people and raising rents, and that's how you make money. So that's one of the really messed up parts of it, the whole pension thing. The other part I think that I like to think about is kind of this, where, you know, this kind of settler colonial aspect. So we live in the settler colonial society, and I try to think about what housing and land and property all means within that. So, you know, we have this kind of more this naturalizing, normalizing thing where it's normal to invest in housing and profit from it. And this is, it's kind of used as a main investment vehicle or a vehicle of attaining wealth or building wealth. And it doesn't even necessarily have to be like, when I say wealth, not like grand wealth, but like, which of course a lot of entities and people have tons of wealth in this country, all based on, you know, at least at one point in time of stealing land, exploiting labor or whatnot. So try to push back on these narratives of, you know, where there's really wealthy people that just came here and, you know, worked the plow, worked real hard, and now they're, you know, they worked for everything they got, and this is what they deserve. But in reality, the land that they built this wealth off of is indigenous land. So we have this kind of aspect of that, the settler colonial, I think, the kind of one of the pillar, the fundamental pillars of settler colonialism, stealing indigenous land, dispossessing indigenous peoples from their land, and then converting it into private property, and then profiting from it, deriving wealth, extracting wealth from it, and building settler intergenerational wealth in those regards. But I think housing is, and I'm kind of just thinking of this as I go, I like to write it all down at some point, but I think housing is part of that. Where it's kind of like the investment thing, where kind of anyone, not anyone can engage in it, but if anyone kind of has an opportunity, it's to kind of grow a little bit of wealth. It's, you know, the normal natural place that we think of here in Canada and other countries is to invest in housing. And I consume kind of mainstream media on a nightly basis, radio and TV, whatever. And there's a story on every night about, you know, how can normal people attain home ownership? It's like, it's seen as this kind of God-given naturalized right in this country, but there's a lot of repercussions to it.
Yeah. I think about here, you know, the blurring of the lines of efficacy, you could say, where, you know, making decisions that we consider ethical in our consumption has become such a difficult thing. You know, we often say stuff like there is no ethical consumption under capitalism, but there's varying degrees of this. And it's made more and more difficult when the lines here are blurred, where the responsibility is blurred, where, you know, it becomes such a big thing that, you know, individuals don't feel like they're really a part of it. And by getting more and more people involved in it, by normalizing it, it, you know, you start then thinking, oh, well, you know, the interests of the capitalists are my interests as well. And it's a great way to keep the working class in line, right? I guess, like, for people who are struggling, it's difficult to figure out how to keep your head above the water while making ethical decisions, right? It seems like everything is a trap. And housing's no different than that in any way, right? Like, even like one thought that I had was when I had to move recently, right? And my unit was somewhat recently renovated. And the thought is, was somebody renovated here? Is this like, was somebody who lived here for a very long time kicked out? And now I am coming into this inflated rental price, and what is the efficacy of that, you know? But at the same time, I couldn't afford anything else, you know? It was like literally the only thing I could afford. So it's like, I don't know, making those decisions, I think it's very difficult for people.
Well, Andy, even at the the beginning of your book, you talk about having to purchase a home simply to secure adequate, safe housing for your mom, right? It wasn't most, for most people, it's actually not an investment, but a necessity, right? Because of the state of the rental market and the precariousness of it all. And the just sometimes the state of rental units, like the physical state, air quality, disrepair. I mean, that's how we get to these demo evictions in the first place, right? Is these landlords just allow the conditions to deteriorate to a point where a complete reno or a demo and rebuild is the only option. And I feel, well, I'm sure you've thought of this because it's throughout your book, but I feel like that's that settler colonial urbanism that you talk about, that plays hard into how the city of Ottawa and developers viewed Herongate, right? It was like that second stage of colonialism. First we come and they don't have enough farms, so we'll fix that. We'll settle this land proper, right? Like we'll improve it the way we see it as improved. And then this is just not good enough, right? This area became too low income, too colorful, right? Too racialized. And so we're going to come in and we're going to clean it up, right? Because they don't even hide the fact. Well, they try to say it's just in such disrepair, but it's about making Ottawa safer and more livable as though this community wasn't that, right? It's another real colonial white man's and woman's mindset to like view this vibrant community that does need repair as something to just bulldoze, rebuild in their image, their very white gentrified image to kind of match the neighboring area. I don't know if you want to unpack how like municipalities play into this kind of colonial project that continues in these neighborhoods.
Yeah, I think you said that better than I wrote it down. I think, yeah, that's painting like a really concise kind of summary of what's happened there, what's happened at Herongate. But yeah, the municipality, we can't let cities off the hook who plan for this type of thing. Yeah, you mentioned the livable city really drew me into how to in terms of like doing a book or doing a PhD research, like how to formulate a research question. It's like, well, simultaneously while this mass eviction is happening or being announced and planned in Herongate, the city of Ottawa is also announcing its plan to transform itself into North America's most livable mid-sized city. So that, you know, begs the question, what does livability mean, or who defines what is livable and what's not? But then as you're saying, it's like we dig a little bit deeper and talk about like revitalization. They talk about revitalization. To me, that's directly linked with making a place livable or relivable or revitalized with, you know, it's about injecting vitality into a place that is deemed to not be vital or have vitality or vibrancy in the first place. So the Herongate and surrounding areas are targeted for revitalization initiatives, as well as part of that is to harmonize it with the wider community to the north, as you mentioned. So like, yeah, we didn't need to submit freedom of information requests to get this information. It is part of the vision of the Herongate's redevelopment. It's on that slide. It's like there's a one sentence vision, and it's about harmonizing Herongate with surrounding communities. And surrounding communities to the north of Heron Road is Alta Vista, and the Herongate Tenant Coalition has done amazing research. Well, first they've done kind of census demographic research in Herongate to understand who was getting evicted from the in 2018. 93% people of color. They went door to door. They did their own census. They've also looked at the demographics in Alta Vista and compared them with Herongate. Alta Vista is predominantly white, 80-90%.
The name gives it away, Alta Vista. It sounds like a California gated community.
Yeah. There you go. Yeah. Yeah. Tons of wealth, you know, much higher than average Ottawa wealth income or like income. And then Herongate Tenant Coalition compares Alta Vista, Ottawa and Herongate and shows these grave disparities. The first dem eviction happened in 2016, and that parcel of land has since been redeveloped. It's now open, you can rent there. But they named that, well, first they were going to name it Vistas South, So Alta Vista, they're going to call it Vista South, and they settled with Vista Local. Now it's called Vista Local.
That's awful.
Yeah, it fits in this with the idea of it harmonizing this vision, this vision of revitalizing Haringate and harmonizing it. And it's not lost on anyone. You don't need to kind of analyze this with some grand theory. Everyone there understands exactly what's happening.
I'm sorry. I'm just like, they're branding our neighborhoods, right? They're like literally branding them. Like there's just nothing community about the fact. It's like when they start naming the dinosaurs in Jurassic Park and the scientists like groan about it.
Yeah.
Pepsisaurus or whatever, like the ideas. It's like, this is what it is. And when will it stop where they'll own everything and price us out of anything?
Do you know what Alta Vista means in Spanish?
High point. High view.
High view.
See, my Spanish isn't that bad, Santiago. It's not that bad. It's so cringe.
High view. That's worth commenting. That's, yes.
I wanted to see if you had any insight, and just like full disclosure, I'm going to ask you a question about the new Renter's Bill of Rights. We've heard a little bit, and you shared it. We've heard from few other people on the very dirty, specific tactics used by landlords against tenants on rent strike or just causing a fuss. Do you have any insight as into broader strokes, right? Rather than like the misleading letters, the threats, the trying to shut down their Twitter account by calling them criminals. That's a new one. New low, I think. Maybe I just don't know what, you know, because in my mind, I'm thinking of Trudeau's tying rental payments to credit scores as being a tool of these larger real estate investment companies and not actually a benefit for renters at all. But let me influence your take. I mean, are there policy changes that landlords are going after to respond to the tenant organizing specifically, not just to make more money, because they're always working on that, but surely they see the rise in tenant organizing.
Oh, yeah.
And it's got to be making them nervous. It's costing them money, right? Like they don't have infinite funds. It may feel like that, but they still need a bottom line to be proud of, mm-hmm. right, for their shareholders. How are they going to try to stop us?
Yeah, no, they will continue to do what they do. So they have a lot of power and influence to influence legislation, to influence policy, and they use that. You know, we saw that around legislation in Ontario anyway, around the pandemic. Yeah, we have these kinds of policies and legislations that have these really nice names, whatever they are, around protecting tenants and the tenant protection bill or whatever. In Ontario anyway, you know, these pieces of legislation that were in the name of protecting tenants were heavily influenced by landlords. And we see a lot of, I mean, I think going back to the Tenant Protection Act of 1997 in Ontario, it's not called that anymore. But if we just look at that as, and I'm sure there are other examples before that, but looking back to that, it really eroded tenant protections as kind of a key piece of legislation in Ontario anyway, that, you know, kind of paved the way for the hyper commodification and financialization of rental housing in Ontario. So I think we just use that, and then we can look at all the specific examples today as a macro level. And then I'm just thinking of this. So the bigger broad strokes there is that I don't think tenants are at the table as much as landlords in drafting these policies and pieces of legislation. And I think of that in line with how this master plan for Haringate was negotiated or was devised. The master plan is this proposal that was approved to demolish many more buildings in Haringate and redevelop the whole neighborhood. But the Haringate Tenant Coalition, for example, was not involved in that. I think ACORN may have been invited. ACORN did good work around the organizing there too. But I think like ACORN would have been the token group invited to kind of give input into this master plan.
You mean invited by the municipality as though they were taking the community's input?
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm not,
I understand.
I'm not sure exactly like kind of what happened, but I think it's the same for we can look at a lot of different political social situations as well when these plans are being kind of drafted to that impact people's lives, and they're just not people that are impacted or just aren't at the table. So I think it happens at kind of the more micro scale of master planning Harringate, and then as well as more, you know, the other scales of politics and law, where I think landlords and these types of companies have a lot of sway in how in the types of policies and legislation that are being drafted.
We hear that. You know, Galen Weston has his hands into real estate investment quite deeply now. And we know he was the first person to meet with Doug Ford when he became premier. So what was your biggest takeaway from 4 years with looking at Harringate, especially now that you're 2 years removed? Like, did you learn anything since then that maybe changed how you reflect back on the book?
That's a really good question. I tell my students to always reflect and be self-reflexive. It's a good exercise for me to do that as well. Yeah, because I'm asked a lot of different questions about the struggle. And I'm always, you know, I'm still presenting, still kind of doing research on housing and, you know, kind of prompted to look back on kind of successes and failures and things like that. I don't really like thinking about it in those terms of successes and failures, because ultimately at the end of the day, all the people in 2018 were evicted and have moved out of the community. So that's kind of, it's a huge downer. It's not a win. It's not a happy ending type of story, where we do have a little bit of hope for these families is in the human rights case that you mentioned. So,
but that's just 36 people in the court case, right? Like that won't help the hundreds already having to uproot.
Right. But if the tribunal rules in favor of the displaced folks who brought the case forward, they are seeking a right to return to the neighborhood. So this could set precedent where you can't just dismantle a community, disperse its residents with impunity. So it would allow those families, 105 families or whatever, to return to the neighborhood. I don't know what that would actually look like in practice, but that's what it's all about.
It would really complicate gentrification plans,
yeah.
Right? Future gentrification plans, especially at least in the province of Ontario.
Yeah, it's all about a right to return. You have a right to return to units of similar size and rent. I don't know if it has changed at all, but it's thinking more and also watching what other movements are doing and have done and are doing and continue to do, which is really academically, I call it like a praxis of refusal. So it's like it's just refusing to accept these conditions of your displacement and demise, you know, refusing to accept that these types of entities and kind of landlords in general can buy your housing as an asset and just remove you from it because they don't like the amount that you're paying them every month. So it's kind of this act of refusal. And it's not about, even if the coalition were invited to this master plan negotiation, they wouldn't have come to the table because they're not interested in negotiating the larger gentrification and demolition of their community, because that's what the master plan is. It's demolishing 559 more homes and building some 50 some new towers. And they don't have a lot, you know, they're up against powerful forces because there's this general consensus that intensification, densification is good. We need more housing. We need more supply. So they're kind of outliers in that, you know, in this outright refusal. No more demolition. You're demolishing actually existing affordable housing, and that's not okay.
Do they get labeled NIMBYs? Because I mean, like, that is often a label that's thrown at anybody who doesn't want density in their neighborhood. But this is much deeper than that. But I imagine that label is quite convenient to those that are selling that Ottawa vision of bringing it into the whatever 22nd century? I don't know what we're working.
Well, I mean, the neighborhood's already quite dense. I mean, if you compare it to Alta Vista,
it's actually the densest, right? I was trying to do some research myself before this, but I believe it was one of the densest neighborhoods in Ottawa already. Yeah, the most densely populated neighborhood in the Ottawa-Gatineau region. So it's not like they're trying to resist the things that we're calling for, right? Building up instead of out. This is not that.
No, it's just not on the homes of existing affordable homes that house these intergenerational families. So one positive that is, I don't know how to frame this, but with all this whole master plan stuff that has transpired since the 2018 eviction, the master plans, this redevelopment that was approved by Ottawa, it was kind of spearheaded by Ottawa. Like it was, you know, it was this, what did they call it? This team effort between the city of Ottawa, Timber Creek, Hazelview, and the design team.
I'm sure raising their campaign funds was a team effort too.
Yeah. Yeah. So what, something that has come out of this, of kind of this tenant organizing on the ground, is that the landlord developer has committed to a few things, but what they've committed to is not displacing anyone else. So even though they're going to demolish hundreds more homes, I think there's a legally binding, I don't know what the enforcement mechanisms are, but the efforts of the Haringey Tenant Coalition, I think this kind of real fierce pushback to eviction in 2018 has created the conditions where no one else should be forcibly displaced from the neighborhood. The redevelopment plan has committed to giving, you know, before demolishing, the family will have housing elsewhere in the neighborhood. I don't think tenant movements need to take lessons from academics and researchers, but it's a broader lesson that kind of this kind of unconventional tactics, direct action can yield these types of results, whereas their detractors would say, well, you should just be voting and calling on your counselor to put forward a bylaw or something. So I think that one element that's come out of this that's been pretty powerful. I don't know what this coalition would say about this. Coalition's really, they don't want any more demolitions in the Haringey, and I'm not advocating for that either. But with this plan, there will be no more, supposedly no more displacement.
I can get their position too, right? It's a hard line that they should hold. And the right to return is definitely an interesting one on how that would be fulfilled. But we were nodding along in agreement, obviously, as you talk about the impact of direct action versus, you know, more a lobbying approach. That's the whole point of our podcast, really, is to encourage people to find more disruptive avenues for change. And I think tenant organizing in this way is one of the prime examples of, you know, harnessing people power, but then this praxis of refusal is, I feel like, the new name of our podcast, even, because like that's the mentality that we need to cement. We have such deference to authority, but it's fading. And the refusal to accept these conditions under which we're living, whether it's bad landlords or genocidal governments, it's just this refusal to not only accept it, but to use the avenues of change that they've set for us, right? Creating our own points of pressure, right? That maybe we didn't even know existed. Thank you so much, Andrew, for coming on and unpacking a lot of that with us. I feel a few of those themes, though, could be obviously huge entire discussions. Is there anything you want to add before we sign off? Or Santiago, hello. He's still here, people. It's the final week of university for Santiago, so he's just keeping me company for today. He's soaking it up with the rest of you. Hang in there, buddy. But Andy, yeah, is there anything you wanted to share that we didn't get to pull out of you?
Not off the top of my head. I think I'm good. I mean, I just really appreciate the opportunity to have this conversation. And yeah, it's an important conversation. And I hope that, some of the themes can be moved forward, and looking forward to to hearing more about them.
That is a wrap on another episode of Blueprints of Disruption. Thank you for joining us. Also, a very big thank you to the producer of our show, Santiago Helu Quintero. Blueprints of Disruption is an independent production operated cooperatively. You can follow us on Twitter at BP of Disruption. If you'd like to help us continue disrupting the status quo, please share our content, and if you have the means, consider becoming a patron. Not only does our support come from the progressive community, so does our content. So reach out to us and let us know what or who we should be amplifying. So until next time, keep disrupting.